Welcome. Who's here?
Hi. This is Lalia calling
in. Welcome. How are you?
I'm great. I'm unfortunately in travel mode, so I might phase in and out depending on how the show
Okay. Well, I'm glad you could join us. Any wins or progress notes you want to share?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. Not right now. Thanks. I haven't really processed things because I'm, because being on the road somehow, I can't focus in that way. So,
okay.
But I'm happy to be here and see, you know, take the
Okay, well, I'm glad. I sure understand that you're traveling and preoccupied, but I'm glad you could join us. So jump in anytime you'd like to join in the discussion, okay?
Okay, I will.
Super.
Thank you.
Super. Who else? Other wins and progress notes? Anyone?
Dave, this is Jerry Finney.
Well,
welcome.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. What's going on?
I just have a question. I'm still, from last week, I didn't understand at the end you said make an appointment time with yourself for meditation and brainstorming.
Brainstorming, yeah.
Meditation I get. Brainstorming, I had never heard that as a personal care kind of item, and I'm still curious and trying to understand that.
Okay, let me tell you what I mean by that. And I'm glad you sent an email about that because I did want to come back to that. It's a personal time that I think can be very effective because it's really a time that if you decide is going to be your time and you make an appointment with yourself, appoint a time that you set aside without interruption, say 15 minutes or 30 minutes, whatever you decide it is, that you're going to brainstorm about a specific focused area. For example, I will brainstorm about the various offerings and planning that I have for the next quarter, what kind of are the next year, some focused area of what I want to repeat, what I want to create, what I want to offer, and focus on that just to look at having a creative time where you're in a state of mind, and this is the key, to be in a state of mind to brainstorm, not to plan or outline, but just to really brainstorm about gathering all the ideas that you can, a free flow of information without necessarily focusing on the how-to, but just kind of like you'd be in a brainstorm with a small group, a brainstorm session with yourself around a specific area so that you can really think about all the possibilities. That may be a book you want to write. That may be, you know, an offering you want to have and look at all the aspects you want to include. It can be as narrow or as broad a focus, but it would be a focus. And it's a time that you create a state that you allow yourself that free flow of idea, kind of a free association but around a specific topic. Does that make sense?
That's very helpful. Thanks.
I
didn't know if it was about just brainstorming personal issues or brainstorming like kind of work focused. So that's really helpful.
Yeah, any of the above, because it's a way to create a state of mind that kind of transcends the ordinary cause and effect, the logical sequence, and it's a really creative time. I find it's really useful when I want to, you know, look at something that I want to plan, and I'll create. I have two companions that I use for my brainstorming. They're absolutely reliable, predictable brainstorming companions. It's a particular kind of single malt scotch and a particular kind of cigar, and I have a favorite setting. it's on the porch at my ranch overlooking a lake, and we have had some amazing ideas. Most of them I remember.
I got it.
Yeah, write them down. Actually, I do.
Do you think tequila would work for that?
Oh, I think so. I don't know.
Okay. All right.
It depends on your biorhythms and your particular chemistry. I'm serious about being aware of your particular style. If your style of getting things down is to write it out on a yellow pad, or if it's to talk it, mine is to talk it. So I have a little digital dictaphone I plug in and do everything on iDictate. You know, sometimes, you know, some people like to see it manifest on the screen when they type. So be aware of your particular style, your particular biorhythms for time that you want to be creative. And then there are other times that you'll be aware of things that you'll want to do that require a different state of mind, like editing. So creative writing and editing, two very different states of mind, two different times to schedule and to preserve that time, not to go back and forth, because it's changing of state that creates a departure of energy, a depletion of energy. So stay in one state. And that's why I emphasize an appointment with yourself for a creative time like brainstorming. So good question. I think it's useful because I realize it probably wasn't self-explanatory. So thanks for mentioning that.
Sure.
Who else wants to check in with any wins or progress notes or challenges?
Hi, Dave. This is Jen Powers. I'm here.
Welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. What's going on with you?
Well, I was away at a family reunion and a conference for our book, and back and a little bit out of sorts, to be honest. This is our first day back, and I do feel a little bit behind, in all honesty.
Yeah, understandably. How's your book going?
Good. The teen book is now out. You know, my husband and I co-authored the teen version of O-Shift, so that's the one we are really hitting hard, and it's amazing, Dave. It's just crazy.
And you generated, like, retreats and workshops around it as well?
Yeah, workshops and a curriculum, actually, a workbook with a facilitator's guide. So it's been, it's been good.
Who are you mostly training as facilitators? Other coaches or?
No, nonprofits and schools, staff, volunteers. Yeah, people that serve the teens and youth population.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's good. Youth at Risk. Really good. Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks. But I'm excited to be here today. So thank you.
All right, super. Great. Who else? Anybody else want to jump in with wins, progress notes, or questions or challenges? Okay, anything about any of the material that you'd like to clarify or talk about a bit, or any of your cases that you want to talk about a bit before we move into the material for today? Anything that would be helpful?
This is Terry Sunny again. I guess I'm the perpetual questioner. In the reading, there was some indication about state of mind, and I kind of put a question mark next to that when I read it. But then when you were just talking about brainstorming in a specific state of mind, I think that addressed what you were talking about. But I'd be curious about a little bit more about that if you wanted to expand.
I think that is the most important aspect of coaching, actually. So we're going to spend an entire seminar on it, and you'll notice that the entire fourth module is on that. And I want to really be sure that we have enough time on that just as a brief introduction right now for what I'm talking about. We each have several different states of mind, and each state of mind is like a software program. That when you're in a particular software program, that program determines what you perceive out of an infinite number of possibilities, and then once input, how it's processed. So it determines how you perceive, process, and behave. And the state of mind that you're in determines the meaning you attach to something at a midbrain level, and the meaning you attach to something determines your behavior. So it is, I believe, the most important success factor that people have to understand and regulate states of mind. And let me give you a very simple example. It's kind of an extreme example, but it'll give you an idea of the specificity of a state of mind, because we usually have access to many different states of mind when we're centered and grounded. We have access to all of our states of mind, and most importantly, the information that's in all of those states of mind. think about when you're just a little bit off center, there's a familiar name or person or thing that you just can't quite think of. And you know it's on the tip of your tongue, but you just kind of block. You can't think of it. And then in a little bit, you kind of relax, forgotten about it, and boom, you think about it. So that's how states of mind work. And let me give you a specific example. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the cheese again and again. Now, if before you teach the rat to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine to create a stress simulation, you teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you take the amphetamine away from the rat, it can't get to the cheese. It can have in a part of its brain the information about how to get to the cheese, but it can literally in that maze die of starvation because it can't access that information. You re-inject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific learning and state-specific memory. And we usually have a kind of fluid movement among our states where they're not extreme. But think about at extreme times of anxiety, where there's a pinpoint focus, of emotionality, where there's a focus on the most recent event and it's more charged. Think of the telescoped focus you have when you're about to speak as opposed to the relaxed focus when you're about to go to sleep. So we have various states of mind, and an important aspect is learning to recognize what state works best for what and how to enter and how to exit that state. And we'll talk a lot more about that when we get to Module 4. An example of that that I gave is a certain state of mind works better for creative writing, and a certain state works better for editing. And you don't want to mix those two and go back and forth because they're two different parts of the brain, really, two different states of mind. So a way of being really centered and grounded as we work with a client is a way that we have access to all of our states of mind and all the information and have that synthesis and integration and creativity. And does that make sense, at least in a preliminary way?
It makes total sense. Like state-dependent learning, I totally get.
Yeah. And we're going to look at some aspects of practical ways to make use of understanding states of mind and how our mind and brain works as we get to that. In fact, today we're going to begin. We've looked at recognizing authorship, owning your story, and assessing plot and storyline, the first three steps. When we look at step four in more detail today about decide what to change, we're going to look at knowing how your minds and brains operate that are going to make you better coaches. And I think that's going to be very useful to you, and it's really kind of a precursor to understanding states of mind and creating effective ways to work with clients in a much more effective and efficient way that can integrate the psychology and the neuroscience of change and to make change that lasts and to help people create change when they've been stuck before and when usual techniques of coaching don't really work to really affect change when somebody is stuck or frightened of change or just doesn't know how to change. Okay, so that's kind of a preliminary answer and a more to come part of it too.
Great. Thanks.
Absolutely. Other thoughts or questions or things you'd like us to talk about? Well, let's move into our material because there may be some things that you'll want to discuss a bit more as we talk about that. And again, I would recommend when you can create an opportunity, maybe even schedule an appointment with yourself, to do some of the exercises. It can really bring the material alive, and it can help also for you to see what you may want to use with a client, what will be beneficial and what you may not care for or have suggestions for revising. So today, in looking at step four, decide what to change, we're going to talk about choice architecture, specifically about identity, choice, and the mind-brain dynamics. Now, here's a precept for this step. Part of the struggle to get people to embrace change is because the methods to facilitate change are often contrary to the way the mind and brain work. And then despite being presented with good evidence, ample evidence of how change can be beneficial, many people don't make changes even when they know it's in their best interest. So here's a very brief recap to set the stage for step four. Story is the narrative thread of our experience. Not what literally happens, but what we make of what happens, what we tell ourselves and each others. This becomes what we remember. You make your world fit into the story you're writing, so it's very useful, necessary to understand how you write your story, because your story determines your future by predicting it. You write your story, then your story shapes you, determines your relationship with everything. And your present and future story is yours to write. Let's first look at identity. And again, thank you for managing the background noise, but also feel free to stop me or ask or add something whenever you'd like. Your identity is not your behavior or habits. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will be harder to change. If you say, well, I'm a procrastinator, or I'm a compulsive shopper, that simply describes behavior that has been a choice and a collection of repetitions that you can even label as a habit. But it's not an identity. And if someone uses that as an identity or sees it as an identity, for me, that's a coachable moment. And you'll come to see, I have a lot of coachable moments. That's why I really rely on the rule of engagement about interrupting, because it's something that I think when someone is writing a story, if there is a counterproductive or non-productive component of that, I want us to look at it right there as it's being constructed in vivo, not waiting later. Could I get you to be aware of the paper shuffling that your receiver is picking that up, and you don't hear it yourself. But if you would do a mute star six until you're ready to talk. Mute star six, because I'm hearing the paper and the microphone movement or some kind of movement. Now, we listen to other people's stories, how they make up who they are, what they need, including from us as coaches, how they teach us to respond to them. And that's a huge clue about what comes alive in the coaching process. People become the stories of who they think they are. And these stories inevitably leave something out, from a blind spot even to the shadow side of what's wonderful. That something can become an abiding quest, a want or a need that can actually define. So remember the equation from last seminar. Belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. Here are a couple of examples of basic storylines that show how a belief can lead to behaviors. A wish for approval or acceptance. On the one hand, it can lead to superachievement and benevolent acts, or it can lead to someone taking too many risks or refusing to take risks, or someone never saying no, promising too much and getting stretched. Another example, the need for harmony can power affiliation and social achievement. It can also make it difficult for people to stand up for themselves when they have a different opinion, or to disregard a need. Remember my client from last session who said yes to everyone except himself and his self-care. Let's look now at choice, and this is something that we regularly engage with our clients as coaches. For this step, decide what to change. I want to add an equation. It captures the principle that you either create your reality or you agree to it. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience is the result of how you respond to an event in your life. Achievement is an outcome. It's a result of responding in certain ways. It's not what happens to us, but our response to what happens to us that makes the difference. So if you don't like the outcomes you're experiencing, you have two possible things to focus on, either the event or the response. If you focus on the event, you can blame the event. Sorry I'm late, the traffic on I-10 was terrible. Or my personal favorite, the assembly instructions didn't make sense. Or if I get really desperate, they left out a piece. Or you can focus on the response. You can change your response to the events to get the outcome you want. But to do that, you have to take responsibility, give up blaming. So remember this essential principle for ownership of your life story. In adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, and now your business is slumping. Choice, then, is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset with its own text. This is how that can sound. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I don't think I can do it. The absence of the awareness of choice limits possibility. So here's a footnote on that. Whatever you're doing that you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, a person, a process, a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results. An addiction really is defined as when a behavior becomes the central organizing factor of your life. So, have you noticed that people specialize, that they keep having the same success or the same problem? If success with money and business startups is the focus, we see a serial entrepreneur. If the problem is with relationships, it keeps getting repeated. Catherine Ann Porter said, his mother rejected him. 1,000 women since have paid for that. Now, here's another related notion to consider. First for yourself, then you'll recognize it more readily when you hear it from a client. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that in a little bit of a different way, because it's important in listening to a client in terms of what they see as obstacles. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter, and I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. In other words, rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. It's there when you create it. Consider using your energy to generate something else instead. Another example. A man says, well, I only fall for unavailable women. Well, they're unavailable because they already have partners or they're emotionally unavailable. Since he's afraid of women and intimacy, he feels he needs an obstacle to be in place so he can allow himself awareness of his desire. There's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it safe to want if you're afraid. An example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. Now, the next frame showed the cat that really looked kind of mean, at least as big as the dog. The dog was still barking because the leash was, and all of a sudden, in the middle of a ferocious bark, the leash snapped. So the dog was totally free to go after the cat. He looked back and saw the leash broken and looked astonished, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark his ferocious, just let me at him. So when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, well, I can't find time to exercise. Reflect on the underlying desire and that you're writing your own story. And here's the principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. Now, I want to look at something that I think is really crucial to understand when we engage change. It's how our brain opposes change and how we can use that to facilitate change. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. Findings from the cognitive sciences can inform us how to change a personal or business story. Let's first look at how the brain opposes change and then how to use this information to facilitate success. And remember, when you feel one side of the brain and think on the other, you need a map. Since the brain has a mind of its own, there are 10 precepts of how our brains work that I think we need to consider. Each of these, I believe, will help you in guiding someone to write a new life story. The mechanisms now are sort of complex, but the principles are so simple they're almost elusive. One, change creates discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits have become hardwired into the brain for efficiency and economy. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about the way we drive the same way to work every day. And because of this default mode, we can think about other things or even listen to a book. This default mode is energy efficient because the brain is freed up to do anything. The brain, then, is amazingly adaptive. It's made routine behaviors energy efficient by creating hardwiring and growing new neurons for that purpose. Now, when these habits are confronted and have to change, the basal ganglia, the midbrain where the automatic pilots are, get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default habit. Now, this is not just conscious resistance. The brain itself is resisting change. And the error detection mechanism is firing and saying this isn't right when something new is presented. The brain naturally resists change because to hardwire behavior saves energy. So the brain opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet. So our minds have to lead the way, and the collaboration has to lead the way with clients. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. One of my favorite authors, Ray Kurzweil, in the book The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology, put it really simply. He said, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about it. Two, change creates dissonance. Now, couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine with the mind's inclination to see and to do what we expect and what we're familiar with. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. And we do this by screening information based on expectation as validation. In fact, when people don't see what they expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. The brain has an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors, the differences between what you expect and what you actually perceive. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right. At times, it can be really explicit and abrupt. For example, remember maybe the experience of absentmindedly going to the refrigerator, getting a drink of milk, and then abruptly discover that when you took a sip, it was orange juice? So when this happened, neural firings disrupt the expected flow and use brain energy. So this error detection signal that something's wrong when routine behavior changes means that we have to take this coupling into account when guiding and strategizing about change. practically speaking, what this means is when a client doesn't feel comfortable in the beginning about doing something, that's expectable. That's natural because it simply is validation that they're moving ahead and in new territory or trying something different. It's not an indication to stop because you have to leave your comfort zone, your zone of familiarity, in order to change. So this may be how we help a client reframe something and evolve a new model to understand what they're experiencing as part of the process of change itself. Not, for example, to be read as, well, my gut's telling me that this isn't the right thing. Now, there is a very valid use of intuition, but it's not to be confused with the error detection mechanism and the discomfort of leaving a comfort zone, because that's going to create a kind of trepidation that's really categorically different than intuition that tells you this is the wrong thing to do or this is not right. So that distinction can be important in itself. Now, the good news, the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors. In other words, to optimize behavior. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback and diminished reward. So it also responds to mistakes. And that's great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response and printout to change itself. So remember that when your client is struggling with resisting change, not having success in the way they want, they're frustrated too. They're not doing it to defeat you. And when you empathically resonate with that and understand that, you can help them understand how that is a way that is expectable because that's the way their mind and brain works, and this is how to strategize around that. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. Let's do a brief exercise. If you have a pen, I want to give you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing? Anyone?
3 and 6.
Okay.
9 and 10. And all the rest of the numbers in the whole
universe. And multiples of 3. Okay. All right, thanks. Now consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head, informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. The brain is wired for story, which is in part pattern recognition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. In fact, the guy that Money Magazine calls the wisest investor living today, Peter Bernstein, said extrapolation is the most common mistake in investing when we predict the future based on the past. J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of many jokes. Listing 2 things, then a 3rd non sequitur. Set up, payoff. Several comedians, especially Seinfeld, brilliantly use this. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns at times to make wise and balanced decisions. So we have to be sure we predict and envision the right things and that we're reading patterns in a correct and current way. 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Your COO, Chief Operating Officer of the company, determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither, because both are likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short-term, but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that caused the created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. Remember from quantum physics, we get what we focus on, not what we want. And both of these responses, these seeming reinforcements, as well as threat, focuses on the negative. And you get what you focus on. Now, we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. How many times have you heard, maybe in Coach the Coach or from a client, well, I just need to get motivated to exercise. I need to get motivated to lose weight or to start a better diet. You know from coaching that establishing a goal can enhance motivation. Creating a strategy can enhance concentration and attention. But someone does not have to be motivated to do something. They just have to have a plan and stick to it. A very common example is I work with pro athletes and actors. They are not motivated to get up and go to the gym every morning. Yet they do it because they know that that's what they have to do in order to do what's next. Now, if we have time at the end, I want to do an exercise that I do in keynotes or in live retreats that demonstrate a neuroscientific basis for how motivation is not necessary. If we have time, we'll come back to it. 6, emotions change brain functioning. Anxiety or fear shifts someone into a survival mode that can prevent fluid learning and understanding. In fact, the alarm signals of fear, anxiety, anger, just even irritability or impatience can shanghai the attention of the frontal lobes and cause them to forfeit their optimum functioning. So when emotions are triggered, brain chemicals are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why self-talk is limited. Change your thoughts to change your behavior will work until emotion gets activated. As soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. Now, a classic study looked at the correlation of reward and dopamine response. The assumption had been, and a very reasonable assumption, that when we do something, we get a reward, and then that triggers dopamine release, the pleasure chemical, so there's the internal stimulation and reinforcement for reward. Well, this isn't the way it happens. It's not the reward that causes the spike in dopamine. It's the anticipation of the reward. It's what you plan to purchase, what you plan to spend money on, almost making money, almost eating a certain food. It's the anticipation that triggers the dopamine. When gamblers were studied, they were hooked up to an fMRI, and as they approached a slot machine, that was when the dopamine fired before they ever touched the slot machine. Their dopamine spike was shown to precede touching the machine before they ever received the reward. And this is something that I found with several hundred eating disorder individuals. I had one of the two or three major eating disorder treatment programs in the 80s and early 90s. Every young woman who I ask, at what point did her mood change, did her state of mind change in the sequence if she were, say, a bulimic? 100% of the people, as they looked at it frame by frame, said, before the food ever touched my mouth. The same with a drug, the same with alcohol. It's the anticipation that is state-changing. And that's why, for example, some people are disappointed with a purchase or have buyer's remorse because the long-anticipated event, after they do it, a totally different neurochemical system comes into play. The dopamine is the sprint system, the anticipation, the quick feeling that is the reward feeling. Whenever somebody makes a commitment to do something, purchases something, commits to engage with something, the long-term chemical comes into play, the marathon chemical of norepinephrine. It's not as exciting. That may be why your client, for example, may hit a plateau around 1 or 2 months and conclude, well, if this is all there is, or, you know, I think I'll just do this on my own for a while. You have to ladder the achievement, ladder the successes, ladder the anticipation so that someone doesn't make this shift and have this plateau that they can conclude the wrong thing from. So, how our brains work, number 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. Things that excite us, that provide a little bit of stress short term, enhance learning. Now, the time window on this phenomenon is about 2 hours, and it has to be not over the top as well. But for longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means that with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. Now, and you're beginning to hear already how for so many of these ways that our mind and brain work, the most important success strategy is to regulate state of mind and manage emotion. So many times, someone getting centered and grounded can help them have access to all of their states of mind. Now, this is important, and I'll just give you kind of an assortment of findings and their sources. Just as an example, stress contributes to 85% of all medical problems, Cooper Wellness Program. 70 to 80% of physician visits are stress-related, U.S. Public Health Survey. 52% of executives will die of diseases related to stress, Cooper Wellness. Stress is the number one reason behind sickness from work, G Publishing Survey. And stress undermines work productivity in 9 of 10 companies, Industrial Society Survey. 8, closure to novelty. And think people don't need coaches. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position can get most entrenched. Another place I see this resistance in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he founded 36 years ago to his 2 children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles and relationships, and the whole system then shifts. Now, these last 2 principles, I think, are especially huge for coaching. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. And 2 things, above all, have been found to create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. That's exactly what we do with our clients: co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bust, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain, the midbrain, especially connected with 2 things, creativity and memory. And remember, the hippocampus is the seat of the unconscious because that's where we attach memory. We attach meaning, rather. Whenever any kind of stimulation comes into us, it goes immediately to the amygdala in the midbrain, and then that processes and passes it to the hippocampus to attach meaning. And then the meaning we attach determines the behavior. So that's where the unconscious is. That's where we attach meaning. And it's especially associated with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells. Now, what's your guess about how much exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus? almost 100%. And these findings have recently been replicated in non-invasive human studies, almost exactly replicated the same percentages in University of Medical Students at Hamburg, University of Hamburg Medical Students, and London taxicab drivers. Now, a related finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells decrease. And again, these are the cells. This is the location of creativity and memory more than any other single area. I think that's huge for coaching. 10, neuroplasticity simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, stroke patients who have a dysfunctional arm, the traditional therapy had been to put the good arm in a sling so that they wouldn't further harm themselves or damage it. But when the good arm, I'm sorry, the bad arm was put in a sling, instead of doing that traditional therapy, the good arm in this new therapy was put in a sling, so they had to use their bad arm. When the good arm was put in a sling, so they were forced to use the bad arm, like feeding and dressing, after 10 days of this therapy, the patients regained significant use of an arm that would otherwise have hung useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. So, not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can also be changed depending on its use. For example, an expert Braille reader has a significantly greater area handling the finger reading Braille than someone who doesn't. Same with classical guitarists for their dominant hand. Now, the good news here is we are not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways and new neural networks are formed. New highways to new communities in your brain. So, how do we counter, then, the brain resistance to change? So I think first we can reframe that question. How can we best mentor coach someone? So here are some things that neuroscience teaches us about mentor coaching. One, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and how they respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. As we've talked before, neural networks are a physical fact in the brain. Whenever you have a belief or know a fact, that's an anatomical reality in your brain. And you can't overwrite that simply by presenting another fact that somebody tells you is better. It can't easily be removed or just simply overwritten by another fact. But they do atrophy with disuse as other networks take their place, but it's an inside job. A teacher knows that he can't simply present an explanation to remove an existing neural network from his student's brain. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. As we mentor and co-create change, we have to start where the client is, not where we are. We can't provide the tools for solving problems before they know what the problems are. And one of the most succinct, I know a couple of you heard this, one of the most succinct pieces of supervision I've ever had was from an analytic patient who heard from me what I thought was a pretty savvy interpretation. And as soon as I offered it, there was a pause, and I knew something was going on. And she got up on her elbow, jerked her around and looked at me and said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you. That was the most brilliant, the most succinct thing. We have to be with our client before they can go someplace new with us. Often, in the most simple way of thinking about it, that is to empathically resonate with what their experience is, because where they are is in their feeling state. We make decisions first on an emotional basis, then we kick it up to our forebrain to make it make sense. So often, that's just simply resonating with a client. You know, I understand, or I hear how upsetting that's been for you. So that means that they get that we get it. Now we're on the same common ground. We co-create a common ground. Then we can begin to look at understanding and strategizing and moving ahead. But unless you create that common ground first, you won't be together. Four. Well, this is why fixing doesn't work. You can't just list the four reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network. Four, partly because it's complex and personal, and because it's subjective reality, which is the same thing, it's kind of redundant. Someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. Since prior knowledge is concrete, it's an actual pathway in the brain, the mentor coach needs to begin with discovering prior knowledge. To begin with the concrete, specific examples can help someone become ready for concepts and abstractions and broad principles. And either from the client or from the coach, they can create a common ground because there's something tangible and real. Then you can move to something that's more abstract or greater principles. Now, so let's reduce that even further. Some specific ways that we can help our clients change their minds and brains. One, begin where the client is. You have a better chance of connecting with the neural networks of your clients if you use concrete examples that they already know, even the ones that they've given, their experiences. No one can understand something that's not connected, at least in some way, to existing knowledge and existing experience. Two, help them learn more about what they already know. So we have to begin where someone is, their existing neural networks, and a simple way to do that is for someone to describe the experience and the ideas about what they're talking about and help you understand how they've reached the conclusions they have, because they may not be aware of this step-by-step process. Three, highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks, such as natural talents, behaviors, and patterns that are adaptive to encourage their practice. Four, don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits, on what's positive. Remember, you get what you focus on, and not to focus on the understanding of the negative, because that just grooves the network, the etching further. Five, correct mistaken couplings, which is to say understand and build on existing positive networks. Six, let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lie. Seven, encourage the client to develop their own metaphors, stories, and connections. Stories, analogies, and metaphors create maps. They become maps. To set the stage, engage people to explore possibilities outside their expectations. They may need an experience. They may need to experience what it's like to view things differently. Remember Ben Fletcher's study at the University of Hertfordshire to engage volunteers to do things differently, to be very conscious of choice, and to act on it, and then look at the changes. Nine, the brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. Now, contrast this to the error detection mechanism, and this is not a non sequitur. This is not conflictual. Now, here's the amazing paradox of the brain. While the brain pushes back, like a two-year-old, against new and different information and patterns, because it's an organ of homeostasis, with tracks laid down that we call habits, and the error detection mechanism oversees the protection of those. It also has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations. So how does this work? When someone solves a problem or has an aha experience, an insight, three different parts of the brain light up, and they're vaulted to a new and different state of mind that is more synthetic and integrative and creative. Adrenaline is released. Dopamine is released to because it enhances the pleasure of this creativity. So it sets up an immediate inclination to further creativity by vaulting into a different and more creative state. This is why we ask questions and co-create innovative ideas rather than giving answers or solutions, because first of all, they're our answers. They're our solutions. Nine. Yes, go ahead.
Dave, could you just say eight again, the first sentence that you said?
The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections, because the intrinsic mechanism for novel connection, the aha that we talk of in coaching, the insight that's often referred to in therapy, creates this internal shift of different parts of the brain lighting up and having the chemical release that furthers this to move into a different, a more creative, synthetic, integrated state of mind. So there is an intrinsic reward to aha, insightful moments.
Got it.
Yeah, thanks. Nine, you have to recognize and take ownership of your experience. You won't believe things to be different just because you're told or just because it's a theory. You have to act on it. You have to develop your own metrics and see if it works for you. And finally, 10, when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that completely reversed everything that they saw. Down was up, up was down. So they consistently had to very carefully move about and think about and plan every move they made, because they had to adjust their thinking and plan everything because everything was reversed. Then about day 25, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains had automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had rewired, had developed new neuronal pathways. So everything was normal, and they could move about normally, even with the headgear. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear, however, were given a day off, 24 hours out of the helmets at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. And that emphasizes, especially for simple behavior response things, the importance of consistency, of predictability. Oh, and one more, 11, I guess. Give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. And that just really elaborates on the astronaut with the headgear. What we do in coaching is to really emphasize that, to look at shrinking the change, to look at stepwise things to create a sense of effectiveness, to weekly meeting with our client, to offer small amount of information and plan and change consistently over time. This process yields far better learning and far more successful results than a one-time intensive training unless there's follow-up. And that's the important thing about retreats or workshops or seminars, is to have a follow-up to really make this process a process instead of an event. So, and let me give you an example of this. Some penguins who wanted to learn to fly got together and hired a motivational coach to do an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals, they visualized, they wrote affirmations, they were all into this. After a few hours, one of the penguins had a breakthrough and flew a short distance. They all rallied around this. Others were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. Then the seminar was over. They left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. Okay, what are your thoughts, questions, and things you'd like to talk about this? Does this make sense to you? Does this fit with what you know already? To be sure that we're doing here what I'm really talking about. Or are there things that are different from what you know or your experience that would be helpful for us to address? Remember, off mute is star 6.
Dave?
Yes.
Hi, it's Lalia here.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
I have been following along on my cell phone as I've been traveling.
Yeah.
And I've stopped now. But I really appreciated the way you set this up and began this with kind of the neuroscience behind this and neuroscience behind change and how difficult it is for the mind to change. Because for me, it was important to remember that it is hard to change, and not up to me to kind of try to, even in my mind, force that.
I think I lost you. If you can hear me, I want to elaborate about your point and then come back on when you get a good connection. I think it's especially important for us to remember that when we're working with someone, that one of the basic things that we do is to not take it personally, that we put our ego in a blind trust, because if someone is getting frustrated at us or frustrated at the whole prospect of change and what they're trying to do, it's important not to take it personally, or if we get frustrated with them, it's important not to take it personally because they're frustrated too. That's a natural and understandable reaction to their attempting change and having difficulty, and that's exactly why they're coming to us. That's exactly what they're paying you for, because you're experts at change. You're going to help them understand not only how their minds and brains work, but how to effectively navigate change that lasts. And that's really what this is about, is to have a way to understand what they're experiencing so that we can teach it back to them, so that they can engage their process in a much more effective way. And I think that's crucial, that we don't take it personally, and that we alone uniquely respond to someone different than perhaps every other person in that person's life, because we're not going to take it personally. We're going to understand their experience, teach it back to them, and teach them how to do it better and how to do it more effectively, how to create change and change that lasts. So that's what our objective is in understanding what their experience is, of resonating with their experience, and helping them to know why this is, so that they can evolve the model of understanding and of change along with the changes that they make. So thanks for mentioning that. Was there more that we lost because of your connection, Lalia?
Yes, actually, I'm back.
Okay.
Thank you, but thanks. I came back in just as you talked about the model of change, and I thought that hits it on the nail. Understanding the model of that is really useful for me. Thank you.
Absolutely. Okay. Other thoughts or questions?
I have a question. This is Carrie Finney.
Yeah.
So when our clients are in that place where they're really uncomfortable before they've laid down kind of the new neural pathways, how important do you think the relationship is in terms of offering them a bit of comfort? Do you think that's important at all?
Absolutely. I think everything in coaching happens through the relationship. So the relationship, I think, is always there. It's always the crucible within which we work. And everything important occurs within and because of the relationship. In fact, it's the when we look at the developmental process of coaching and just the entire developmental sequence of the coaching engagement, it's really the developmental process of a relationship. Because the first aspect, the first developmental phase of the relationship is the creation of a working alliance. And that is important because it means both you and the client understand and are engaged together in this mutual endeavor, that it's collaborative. That makes it unique and different than every other professional relationship in which they've ever been engaged, is that you're in a collaborative model working together, and you're working on the client's goals and objectives, and you're a catalyst for that. So that is so important to establish, because what that means then is when you have that working alliance, the client knows two things, especially far and away. One is that you believe in him or her, which I think is the most important thing that can happen in that relationship, which is why I never work with anyone in whom I don't believe. That you believe in that. And neuroscience has shown, and this is reiterating something we've already talked about, neuroscience has shown when you believe in someone, it actually changes their state of mind. So to believe in someone and then to be able to collaborate with them about looking at something in a new way, meaning that when you have this working alliance, they know that you have their best interest at heart. So you believe in them, they know you have their best interest at heart for their success, and you may be the only person in their lives who is 100% dedicated to their success. Even the most loving partner is 99%, because inevitably they're human, and they have their own interests. But you can be 100% dedicated. That means that you're going to have to do things within that working alliance that are not going to be pleasant or comfortable for the client. That means that you're going to have to be able to get away with saying things that are confrontive, that are story-busting, that look at things that are characterological for that person, that have been ways that they've created glass ceilings for themselves, that, and this is a key part, that has come alive in the relationship with you, so it's no longer a theory. It's no longer out there. It's what has come alive in the work with you, and now the very thing that's gotten in the way of working with everyone else that has been important, that they've worked with in certain ways, that's going to manifest now with you, and you're going to have to not only be able to not take it personally, but to understand it, convey that understanding, and look at alternate ways of proceeding that can create a successful journey for the client. So I think is the relationship is everything. And that's why I think it's so important to begin with the relationship, to make it real, to make it viable. We're going to return to this at a different point. Much later toward the end, because I want to revisit your question again in light of some of the things we've talked about to show you and that you'll see and feel and be able to show me how important the relationship is. So that this is just a précis of some things we're going to be talking about how crucial and how powerful the relationship is. Now, you had some ideas or assumptions to give rise to the question. What would you have said if I would have asked, which I should have, before I gave you my answer. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, my thought is the same, but I'm just, you know, I've been doing therapy for 25 or 30 years, so
yeah.
So I'm just always trying to kind of understand how this relationship is different than the relationship that I would have with somebody that I'm treating as a therapist.
Some of the principles are the same, and the development of a working alliance is very similar. And that's one of the most similar things, and my comments come from my experience of teaching about the working alliance and analysis. So I think it's really important, and I think some of the most fundamental principles are there. Now, do you see other likenesses, and do you see differences in coaching?
Well, the most clear similarity is what you just talked about that we would call transference. You know, when their dynamics, their personality issues come into the relationship and they come alive, and then you can work in that way.
Uh-huh.
And that thing, obviously, that happens in psychotherapy a lot.
Absolutely.
The differences, I'm not sure yet. I'm still learning. So I'm not as clear yet on kind of what the differences would be.
Well, I think in a good therapy or a good analysis, you don't go back and go deeper. You deal with the things as they manifest in the relationship, and that's where the transference is manifest, when somebody uses the models they have to perceive and organize current experience. And the ones that don't work are the ones we usually call transference, but transference is simply the organizing process of using the software that's already been made. Most of it works really well, and it can help us not have to go back and discover the Pacific Ocean every time we want to, look at
right.
water. Yes. Did you say you my name because
yeah,
you want to say something?
Nope, I'm just agreeing.
Oh, yeah. So we only bother transference when it bothers us. Same in coaching. We only look at a belief or an underlying assumption that someone has when it doesn't work, when it doesn't facilitate moving toward goals. We only look at aspects of how someone is organizing and perceiving something in the current experience in the relationship when it gets in the way, or when it's not working, or potentially dysfunctional, or when we just simply don't understand. And I'll say something like, help me understand how you're thinking about that to come to that conclusion. Because often the client doesn't know. And looking at that and looking at their assumptions can be very useful in the process. So we don't bother beliefs or assumptions that are working. We may even want to enhance them. We only bother it when they bother us or the client because they're not working. And that's how they come alive. That's how you don't see the unconscious. You see the derivatives. You see the manifestations in present behavior, and that's where it's real. And that's the depth of coaching, just like the depth of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, is the richness and the complexity in the present moment that yields the benefit. So same in coaching. We're not going to go back and look at understanding dynamics or working through something or how it happened. We're going to look at the choice architecture of this moment and what's working and what's not, because everything we need to know will be manifest, will come alive fully in this moment. And we're just learning to listen fully to how that is and how we can help someone facilitate a better story in the areas where they may need some tweaking or editing. Does that make sense, and does that fit with what you know? Because, and I think this is a really good point for everyone, because it's looking at what do we focus on, how do we use this relationship with a client to create the power and the richness of changing someone, helping someone change their lives.
Yeah, it helps a lot. And I guess one of my fears about doing coaching as opposed to doing psychotherapy is that the relationship wouldn't be as important. And I mean, I've just done so much work out of the relationship that I don't want to give that up. Plus, it's fun. So this is good for me to hear.
Yeah, I found that it's much freer. You know, I didn't think I could have any more fun than doing what I did in therapy and analysis and working with really creative, amazingly successful people. But I found that coaching is even more fun because I get to step out from behind the couch. I can be real and tell stories and mix it up and do all kind of things and co-create stories. And, you know, it's all focused on the client, but it just feels a lot freer to me. And it's just seems a lot more open and more engaging, and people learn more about me when it's helpful to them It's just a much more fun process even. And I didn't think it could be even more fun because I enjoyed the hell out of doing what I was doing.
Yeah.
Great. Well, we're out of time. Let's pick up here next time. And anything that you want to talk about, jot down, and we'll pick up right there next time. Have a great rest of the week. Enjoyed it. Thanks a lot. Bye now.